Welcome to the Business Networking Radio Show with Linda Cloak and John Turner.
Well, hi everyone. It's actually
Hello.
Linda Cloak and Paul.
Advertising your business can sometimes feel like you're trapped down a well, waiting for someone to respond. Choosing to market your business with...
I don't know how I did that. There's too many buttons in front of me. Good morning, everyone. So I thought that was a really good song, actually, to start off with. And the reason I did is because I've just come back from holiday. And actually, you don't need to start me up because I'm just like us all. If I just start up anyway. But anyway, my co-host today is Paul Andrews. And thank you so much for stepping in at the last minute like that, Paul.
That's all right. It's a pleasure. It's lovely to meet you all. We've got Tom and Dave here. Sorry, I'm running around the desk trying to turn off the button she's turned on. We got a big sign on the screen just for Linda that says mic on. Yeah. So that worked for her this morning, but yeah.
Yeah, but the other ones didn't.
Oh, but the other one didn't. It was on auto, that's why it played.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay. So I'd like to welcome Tom Revely from IT Manager Services. So welcome to the show today, and also David Clark.
Good morning.
So they're both going to be telling us about their business and sharing stories. And we're also going to be sharing some events that are going on. There's new networking events launching. I think on Thursday the 18th there's something like 4 events in the evening, which is amazing. So I'm really pleased I haven't got an event on that night. So that's fantastic because I can go to some of the others. How's your week been, Paul?
So far, so good. We're halfway through it. It's been okay, but today's been a little bit of a strange day so far. But we've had a few issues, different places, not here, but other places. But we'll hang in there.
So, did you want to tell our listeners where your, all your office places are?
Yeah. We're based here at the Trading Post in Tenterden, obviously, with the radio studio, and then I have Fruitworks in Canterbury. Which is co-working space, event space, office space, and coffee shop. Mm-hmm. And Island Works in Sheerness, which is a refurbished church, which has a co-working meeting, event, and coffee shop.
So has the Sheppey one got parking there?
Yes, it has. Yeah. Canterbury doesn't.
No. So I've noticed there's a lot more events in Sheppey than there seems to be in...
No, we get as many events in Canterbury. Canterbury is a unique place.
Yeah. Yes.
It has 3 universities. It has a huge number of tourists, and it's a very old city.
Yeah.
So very few people have car parking there.
Mm.
So the population are used to not parking cars there. We've got 120 businesses based in Fruitworks.
Wow.
And although some of them are knocking on in their 40s, they're still basically living in bedsits, eating cold baked beans and skateboarding to work because they're all still ex-students, really. The event space in both locations is really, really heavily booked.
Oh, wow. So yeah. Canterbury is full of Peter Pans.
Yeah.
That's great. So, Tom,
yes.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So, you sponsor the radio show, so we play your advert, actually, every week.
Yep.
But tell us a little bit about your story, because, I've seen a few of your presentations. I love them. But I've never really heard your story.
Okay. So, if I look back to kind of the start of my career in IT then, I was once upon a time a bank manager.
Oh.
Most people don't know that. Whilst I was there, I kind of got a bit disenfranchised with the whole let's sell things to people that they don't want. And that's kind of what banks like to do. So I saw a posting for their internal IT department. So took a secondment for a year, spent my year travelling up and down the country, over to Ireland, just refitting NatWest and RBS branches, putting all the new kit in, really kind of fell in love with it. So when that ended and it was offered, you can either go back and work in a branch or here's some money, go away, took that, ran, and went and decided to kind of start working in IT because it kind of got me. I've kind of flitted between working for smaller companies, so sort of family-run companies, up to ones that everyone's heard of. So like at one point I was the IT manager for the London Eye, London Dungeons, London Sea Life, Madame Tussauds London, and Legoland Windsor. Didn't really enjoy the corporate side of things. Everything's a bit too siloed and as much as you kind of want to make an impact, improve the way people are working, you can't because you don't know how it affects other departments. So I went back to more of the family style of things.
So how long ago did you start it? Because I bet you've seen some drastic changes.
So my first IT role would have been 2007, 2008.
Wow.
Child.
I know. I launched my own website in 2001. When did you launch your own website?
Well, it's worse than that. When did I start working in IT?
Oh.
1971.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I wasn't even alive then.
Wow. I didn't even know IT was around in 1971.
There were two mainframe computers in Kent, and I worked on one of them, which was an ICL 1903T running George II.
Wow.
For those...
A little bit before my time.
Yeah, those kids. Oh,
big was it? How big? I bet it was huge.
It was massive. It was absolutely massive. It filled a room. I wouldn't even begin to think how big the room was. It was massive, massive room. But it did have a whopping 8K of memory.
So was it... was it very similar to the setup in the Italian job in terms of computers?
Fairly similar, yeah, because in those films, what they do to represent a computer is they show you the tape decks, mm-hmm. yeah, and that is true. So the tape decks look like that. The hard disks were about 2 foot high and a foot across, and it weighed an absolute ton to pick it up and put it on the spindle to fire it up. But it did hold nearly a megabyte of data.
Wow. Very impressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Figures must seem so weird to you now when we're talking about all the big amounts that phones hold. And, yeah, I mean, what's a typical phone?
So if you look at, obviously, very kind of time-appropriate, Apple released their latest phone last night, and it's now 2 terabytes of data.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. It's the type of changes brought about by technology are just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. When you're talking 70, what you're talking 50 years ago, yeah, which is a short space of time, mm-hmm. unless you're a human and very old like me, but it's a short space of time historically. Mm-hmm. But the change in technology in those 50 years is absolutely phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
This is about Tom, not about me, but I'll tell you because it's funny. In 1979, I was vice president of electronic banking at Citibank. Mm. Now, bearing in mind that PCs hadn't been invented and certainly the internet hadn't been invented, it was quite an interesting concept because it mostly consisted of bits of wet string and tea and tin cans. So, again, you know, those kind of things have just escalated how you do things. And if you march through technology, the big points in technology are the invention, for want of a better word, of the personal computer,
mm-hmm.
yeah, mm-hmm. Which had a dramatic effect.
Yep.
The internet, obviously, and then mobile phones
mm-hmm.
are the three big points where technology leapfrogged. Yeah,
I remember my husband carrying his phone around in a case.
Yeah.
That's how big it was.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen them. Wasn't around for me.
No.
I know. I can't remember the exact model it was, but I know it was one of the early iPhones. I'm sure it's like the 4 or 5. And they actually said that there was more computing power in that iPhone than was used to send man to the moon.
Mm, absolutely.
And you're using that to send texts and make phone calls.
Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it? I had a Motorola ETAC mobile phone in 1988. It cost me $4,000 and I could only ring one person. And I didn't want to speak to her.
That sounds like my ex-husband's wife. Oh, God.
That would have been my ex-wife, really. Yeah.
So where, I mean, can you see, because I know obviously you deal with, you know, cybersecurity and, you know, IT, is that a small part of your business or is it the main part of your business?
So when we started, I would have said it was a smaller section. Now, I think most of any IT company nowadays, most of their work should be focusing towards the cyber side. It is, yes, you've still got to support the businesses. Absolutely, you do. There's still the training side. There's still kind of that element. But the risks and the sort of issues around cyber are just so sort of growing at such a pace at the moment that it needs to be that focus.
Oh, well, how are businesses, how receptive are they?
When you start speaking to them, when you start kind of showing how easy it is, as obviously you've been to a couple of the talks I've done, and I'll put up examples of how easy it is for an email to come through that looks fairly innocuous, looks like it's come from where it says it's come. And actually a little link or a little hover over the right place shows you it's not. When you start showing people what it could, what the problems could be, what the issues, the implications of what they're doing, their eyes kind of open up and they start actually, yeah, listening a bit more seriously.
And I wonder now, with everything that's going on in the news, if, you know, now businesses will start taking it more seriously.
Yeah, all these things are, you need to really think heavily about what's going on here. We had a funny one during my radio show on Tuesday. Jules, my co-host, had been talking on air about going to Santander Bank. Mm-hmm. Half an hour later, she got a text message saying, please, could you call Santander Bank with da-da-da-da-da, click here. And she went and I went, no. Mm-hmm. Yeah, why are you clicking that? She said, well, because they've asked me to. And I went, couple of points. The Santander Bank you were talking about was in Madrid, yeah? That is not a Spanish phone number. And she said, but so they must have been listening into what I was saying. I went, no, it's coincidence, yeah? If you look at something like that, they send 2 million emails and 10 people happen to have said Santander in the last half an hour, so they will click it, yeah? And that's how it works. And she wouldn't believe me. And I said, but truly, if you look at all the other ones you've got on your phone, yeah, for banks that you've never been in, you just ignore them, yeah? And that's how it works.
Yeah, you see it a lot with sort of delivery drivers. You'll get messages come through, even if it's a text message saying, oh, every try to deliver, click here to... It's not them.
Yeah.
You probably haven't got anything coming from them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're out and about, and it's relying on people in that moment of weakness or just not really thinking about it. Just go, oh, I'll click that.
Yeah.
And then it's too late.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gosh, it's so scary, isn't it? Mm, especially when you've got, like, for companies like us, I mean, obviously we've taken the... steps to make sure it doesn't happen, but you know, when you're holding so many people's data, that's the thing, isn't
it? Yeah, it's scary the amount of data that companies obviously now need to hold on you. And yeah, how easy it is for that to get out,
and public bodies, you know, schools, governments.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, if the KCC got hacked, I mean, they'd be well in trouble, wouldn't they?
Oh, God, yeah.
They wouldn't be able to collect any council tax.
Yeah.
It's like you're advocating for it now.
I sounded quite excited then, didn't I? I know.
I mean, one of the issues, I think, and it's something I want to kind of talk to Tom about, is in the early days when cyber crime started to raise its head, it's always been there, but it started to become more prolific.
Noisier.
Yeah. A huge amount of small companies went, well, we don't have to bother. Nobody's going to bother with us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from my point of view, I think that was the worst kind of thought processes ever, because most small businesses did get hit because they were easy to hit.
Yeah, the problem is it's the big companies that make the news because everyone knows about them. The smaller companies, they're hit far more often because your cyber criminals, they expect you to have no security in place, no procedures in place to just click on things because they're there.
Yeah.
You're not going to have the training because you haven't got the budget to put into that, or at least that's what they assume. And unfortunately, rightly so.
Yeah.
It ruined. Well, I mean, a lot of people know that I had a business. I developed it over 2 years. I spent, you know, I can't even imagine the hours. I got personal loans to get it launched. And then it was hacked, and it was like with Independence Day where the bomb goes into the alien and then he goes, ah, ha, ha. That's actually what was happening on my website. I had that man, that skeleton thing, laughing at me. And I went to show it to someone who was going to sign up for it, and basically this thing came up. When I contacted the police, they said that basically what happened is somebody had hacked it and then they put it out to the black web.
Yeah.
And then... everybody attacked it. So, I mean, I'm still paying all that back now.
Yeah.
I mean, and that was 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
Seven years ago.
It's the reputational damage that then comes alongside that.
Well, it compromised all of my, it compromised everything. So, I mean, I've gone down the WordPress route now.
Yep.
Which, you know, presumably they're, and I'm a bit paranoid about making sure it's all you know, everything's up to date, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
And that's one of those things you could, again, it's people rely on things that are out of date. Out-of-date things, there'll be bugs in there, they've been released to the dark web, people are aware of them, that's what they're going to target. If you try and keep things up to date, you're doing what you can to stop them as much as possible.
Yeah, scary stuff, isn't it?
Oh, it is, and I think most of us have been hit at some point. I lost £135,000 in a scam. And it was really simple. Really simple, despite the fact I had all the procedures in place and everything. Somebody spoofed my email, sent it to my accounts department and went, could you pay this urgently? Don't argue, just pay this now because it's really important. Now, we had procedures in place that said I would never do that under any circumstances. If you think I have, ring me on my personal phone number and ask me.
Mm. They didn't do it.
She paid it, then she rang me.
Oh, not quite the right way around.
Yeah. And that was it. We didn't get the money back.
No. Well, you can't, can you? Because you don't know where it's gone.
Well, we kind of do, but, you know, because it was a bank transfer. Mm. But sometimes the bank will accept responsibility. But in this case, they went, you pressed the button. It's your fault.
You chose to send
And my insurance
money.
Company wouldn't pay out because they said it's a cyber crime. Not really. It's not really a cyber crime, is it?
No.
Tentative. But
yeah. So I lost some money.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So coming away from that and talking about the IT side,
yes.
Hasn't Microsoft done something or doing something? Or?
Microsoft are always doing things.
Yeah, they do quite a few things.
Oh,
some
I know.
Are good, some are not so good.
So if somebody's got Microsoft Office at the moment, that needs to be brought up to date, doesn't it? And all the...
Well, you're looking at... If you're looking at kind of deadlines on the moment on Microsoft, you're looking really more sort of towards the Windows 10 mark. So Windows 10 goes, the class is end of support in October. It's not that it's going to stop working. It's not that suddenly on the 24th of October, it's now a scary thing to have. It's just that Microsoft will no longer fix any holes or any bugs or security issues they find in it. You're on your own. Yes, you can pay them for extra support, but it's ridiculously expensive and it's cheaper just to buy a new computer. But yeah, I think I saw a statistic that's sort of, it's a scary statistic. It's like about 200,000 computers still running Windows 10.
Mm.
That's ignoring the ones that are still running Windows 8, 7, XP.
I was going to say,
still exist.
I went somewhere where someone was still running XP.
I don't even know what I'm running.
You're on a Mac, so you're fine.
Oh, okay. That's good then.
Yeah, you're fine. Yeah. So yeah, if you kind of look down the sort of Windows 7 XP route, you're kind of linking back to, we were touching before the show started, the co-op and the M&S hack. That was all down to someone targeting a very out-of-date machine. I can't remember whether it was XP or 7 they were running, but it's that one legacy machine.
I think it was XP. I think it was XP they targeted, yeah.
It's that legacy machine that's running that really key part of their system they can't get rid of because it won't work on a newer one.
Yeah.
And that's what they go. They go for that weakest link.
Yeah. So what do they do then? If it won't work on a newer one, how can they ensure that it doesn't happen?
There are sort of compatibility settings you can put into place to try and almost trick that program into thinking it's on an older machine. But there's some of them that, again, it's that downtime, it's the moving it over, it's that process. They haven't got the time to do it. And it's easier just to go, but it works. We'll leave that sitting there. And then someone forgets it's still there. And now you're sitting there, like if you go back to what was it, Windows 8 was end of life a decade ago. So Windows XP was before that. And it's still sitting in the corner. And it wouldn't surprise me if it's still sitting there now, even after they went down and their systems were down for a couple of months after that.
To be fair, if mine hadn't broke, I'd probably still be on XP.
you do find things like that. Would you like to hear a silly story?
Go on then. Another
legacy
one.
Yeah, I've got a million of them. I used to, as I just intimated, I worked for a bank. And one of the jobs I had there was head of payment systems. Yeah, and we used a system called SWIFT.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which we lovingly called some Wally's idea of funds transfer. And basically, you transferred funds and they had to be transferred before 4 p.m. in the afternoon, which was a cutoff. Anything that missed that cutoff, we were liable for the overnight interest.
Okay.
We did $26 billion a day, so the overnight interest was quite significant.
Yep.
Yeah. So we tried very hard to get all of our payments in before 4 o'clock. 4:15 one day, I get a phone call from the data center downstairs. the SWIFT process has gone down. We're not transmitting, and we've got 15 minutes, and we've got 12 billion left to pay.
Oh, God.
Oh, God. I go down. What's the matter? For some reason, the interface at the back's gone down. So I was a network engineer originally. Yeah. So I get a breakout box and I start looking. It's got a, for the wonky techies out there, an RS232C V24 interface. Yeah. I put my breakout box on it. The receive line's broken. So I get a paperclip, under the paperclip, shove it in both ends, bang, it comes up and we transmit $12 billion. Yeah. Fast forward, I left the bank a year later. 4 years later, I came back just to visit some of my old mates there, and we were walking around the data centre, and I started telling the story, and I walked around the back of the processor.
Still in there.
And the paperclip's still in there.
That's amazing.
Well, you know, wow. you know the old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Exactly, yeah.
God, dear, oh dear. And what do you feel about techie stuff, David?
I think it's, as a small business, it's a scary sort of subject. It's almost a case of sometimes you don't want to think about it because of how scary it can be and the consequences of it. Mm. And other times you hear the old adage of it's not a case of if, it's a more of a case of when.
Oh, it's definitely a case of when.
Yeah. And you know, trying to put something in place and put things in place to say, well, actually, no, you know, how can we protect ourselves? Mm. You know, to stop that from happening, because it's not just about programs being hacked. It's, you know, as you know, Paul was saying earlier on, it's about the emails coming in, it's about the text messages coming in, it's about the different forms of communication that happen. Mm. That if you're not savvy enough to pay attention to it, you get scammed. Mm. Simple as that.
I see. The biggest thing you can do is train your staff. It is all about training. It's that awareness. If you're aware of what you could be looking for, just keep taking those few seconds to just think before you click. Will save so many headaches.
Mm.
You can put all the tech in place you want to. It's never going to protect you 100%. That person that's clicking on that button is your weakest point.
Yeah.
The training is the best thing you can do for them.
But I think in general, though, thinking specifically about smaller businesses as well, most smaller businesses aren't technology specialists,
mm-hmm.
But there's a huge amount of advantage to be gained from deploying technology in the right way. Mm. But then you then do become susceptible to the technology. My belief is that small businesses must have an accountant. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. something that they really need. And the second thing is they must have an IT specialist if they're not IT savvy themselves.
Of course, I agree with that.
Yeah, because of their times, yeah. But being serious, a company like Tom's is the perfect company for that, because what you need as a small business is to have a relationship with someone that you trust.
Yep.
And that's not to say big companies are untrustworthy, but the problem is, with a big company, you might get anyone turn up to look at your problem, mm-hmm. and you're forever starting from scratch. You know, the engineer walks in, goes, "What's wrong?" Then you go, "Miyoki Coach 2000's fallen over." And they go, "Oh, right. Well, where's that? What's that connected to?" "Oh, here we go again. I've got to explain it all." Whereas if you have a smaller company with a relationship, they already know your setup, and they go, and they already know you as well, and they go, "What have you touched, Linda?"
It's like you know Linda well.
Yeah, yeah.
He's always diving in here to rescue me, and that's just this, let alone what I'm like with a computer. I did something the other day. What was it I did? I did something the other day, and I completely messed it up, and I had to go back and do it all again. And that's, well, I mean, it's me messing it up, and it's me having to do it all again. So that's, you know. Anyway, so... So you just said, you just said about training staff.
Yes.
So what is the process then to get your staff trained for a small company like David's?
So it kind of depends on the systems you're using. If you look at, take it right down to basics, you're looking, everyone's using some form of email system, whether you're going through Outlook, whether you're going through mail on an Apple machine, whether you're using the one that comes with your email provider. It's looking for those little telltales. Obviously, Paul mentioned one, the urgency. If an email comes through and it's pressuring you to do something quickly, whether it's a text, an email, whatever, stop, think, just take a step back. When you're looking at links in both text messages and emails, just have a look at them before you click them. Does it actually look like it's sending you where you think it's going to send you?
You can, some links, you can hover over them and it will show you what the real address is. Yeah.
Yeah. 99% of the time, absolutely, that works. Yeah. I think one of the ones I showed at your
the big event, yeah,
your event in Maidstone. It's one designed by NatWest to show people how easy it is, and it uses Cyrillic characters, right, which is the Russian alphabet.
Yeah.
Hover over or look at it; it's identical.
Yeah.
Unless you put it in italics, and suddenly the letter changes. And that link sends them to a, again, NatWest design, so we're nice and safe. You can click on it. Page to say, well, actually, this is not where you thought you were going to go. You're not going to natwest.com. You're going to some weird and wonderful page. And it's really easy to sneak those in. Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Scary.
It is. It is. Yeah.
So we just spoke about events. So do you want to read out some of the events?
Yes. Yeah, so let me tell you some of the things that are happening around the county. Where are we today? What's the date today? It's the 10th today, isn't it? Yeah. On the 11th, that's tomorrow, manana, Thursday, there's the lunch steer. It doesn't say where it is.
Steer your business.
Huh?
That steer your business.
Yeah.
That'll be down at Curious Brewery.
Right.
Ashford.
Okay. So there's that.
Well done.
Well done, Tom. And then there's Linda, the famous Linda here, doing a presentation in Dartford, at Sisterhood Dartford. That's both on the 11th tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite good because people are actually asking me to do presentations on networking.
Right.
So NBC asked me to do one. Right. And then I've had several people ask me to do those presentations since then. So it's quite good.
Okay. And then tomorrow, Friday the 12th, there's a Moat Park walk.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Right. It's not Friday tomorrow, is it?
No, it's on Friday, I said.
Yeah, it's on Friday.
Yeah, tomorrow, manana's Thursday.
Oh, right.
Yeah. You're speaking in Dartford on Thursday, tomorrow.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But on Friday, which is the day after tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, dear.
There's a walk. Are you going on the walk?
No, I'm not. No, Chris runs that. Okay. So, yeah.
Yeah. So is that like networking?
Yeah, but it's very different. So Chris has got a system. Have you been on them?
No, I haven't managed to make them.
Chris has got a system where literally you talk to one person for 5 to 7 minutes, then he moves you up so that you don't get stuck. Because a lot of networking events, you get stuck. And, you know, as much as you like the person, you're with them for a whole hour.
I have a question.
Go on then.
When you're walking, how does he move you up? Does he scoop you up in a wheelchair and put you forward?
No, he literally says, right, everybody, he stops everybody, he says, right, everyone move up one. So everyone just moves along one.
Wow.
And then what they do is they move round. So basically it means that everyone gets to talk to new people. So the same sort of, you know, idea that we've got at our events to make sure that you are getting to speak to as many people as possible.
Yeah. I've got some more events, but we'll maybe cover them later in the show.
Okay.
Quite a few on there.
I will. Yeah, there's lots of new ones going on. So I'm going to talk to the boys about networking in a mosey. But first off, I've had some people ask me to do a shout out. So Alison Whelan has said, are you tired of wasting hours searching for the perfect holiday only to end up confused and frustrated? Bags are packed travel by Inspire, provides 100% personalised service to take the time, stress and confusion out booking holidays. Phone or WhatsApp 0772 628 6903. Do you guys use travel counsellors or anyone?
Use what, sorry?
You know, someone to do your travel for you. Do you organise it yourself or do you use someone to do your travel for you? When you go abroad, do you do it all?
Yeah.
All right, okay. Do you
You looked really confused by that question.
Yeah, no, I was trying to think. I was trying to think what I'd do. I'd just get in the car and drive, actually.
That's because you go to France.
Yeah.
not much organising needed.
Yeah.
What about you, Tom? Because you go away quite a lot. Do you do it yourself?
You sound like my staff. They say that too. We either myself or the wife tends to organise it depending on where we're going.
Oh, right, yeah, okay.
We like to kind of get involved in that. Well, where do we actually want to go? Where have we not been before? And yeah, do it that way.
David?
Yeah, we tend to do it ourselves. Having said that, we haven't gone abroad for the last couple of years, so
no, that's the thing about being self-employed, isn't it?
Well, yeah, running your own business, we've done quite a big renovation on our house as well, so it's just things to keep us tied at home at the moment.
I've actually always used someone because you know, I struggle to find the time to do it, and I want to know that if something goes wrong. I mean, I remember we went on one holiday when Thomas Cook went down the Swanee, and everyone was stuck,
trying to book their flights home.
And our personal travel person, they got us home and got us a flight and everything. And there was loads of people didn't have it, so it was it was really great having that. Another shout out here is the lovely Sue Lee, who's helped me out in the past. Thanks for the reminder of a shout out. If you're feeling stressed or overwhelmed, Sue from Sue Lee Hypnotherapy is here to help. She's a hypnotherapist, life and health wellness coach with 15 years of experience who supports busy professionals to feel calmer, clearer and more in control. She's on holiday. You can follow her across all, if you're listening to, you can follow her across all social platforms at Sue Lee Hypno, or perhaps book a free discovery call with Sue to see how she can help you with stress SOS pack, SueLeeHypnotherapy.com. So, I mean, you go networking a lot, Tom.
Just a little bit, yeah.
So, tell me your, because you do Entrepreneur Circle, which is completely different. Is it, would they call it networking?
No. So I kind of treat it as business therapy. So they do lots of different events. So some of them are based up where Entrepreneur Circle is based. So that's up in Solihull, Birmingham. Mm-hmm. But they also run local events around the county, around the country. I go to one in Maidstone, which runs out of Edenwood Place, which is, yeah, so it's, yes, you've got a little bit of informal networking beforehand, but then it's a bit more structured after that. So every single meeting, there'll be a book that you're working through, which is, the idea is you're going to go away from that meeting with something that you could put into your business or that you could help use to move your business forward, whether it's looking at your website, whether it's looking at your marketing or your plans for the next year. But yeah, every single month, it's another book of something you're going to go through.
Oh, that's interesting.
Is that a bit like a mastermind?
I was thinking mastermind.
Yeah, exactly the same sort of thing.
But a mastermind tends to only be 8 people. So how many people are there in there?
So the one in Maidstone could be up to sort of 20, 30 people in there. On average, there's always around 15 people or more there. And yeah, it's always really good. If you've got something sort of in your business you want to talk about, you've got a great group of business owners around the table that are happy to sit there and just chat through it with you.
So that's what Leanne Easton is going to be doing. So she's talking about doing, she's got one that's just launching this month called The Long Game. And that one is going to be a business owners who are going to be helping each other to go forward and just help other businesses in Kent. So it's meant to be quite a relaxed affair. I don't think she's looking at doing any sort of training or going away with anything. But to be honest, it's the first one, so I don't know.
It's tomorrow, the 18th, The Long Game in Canterbury.
That's right. Is that tomorrow? That's not tomorrow.
Tomorrow's not the 18th.
It's Thursday week. Sorry, you're quite right.
We're good, aren't we? Everyone's going to be right on model when they finish this show.
It's just a test.
Who's on the ball?
Yeah, no, it's Thursday week. A week tomorrow.
Right, and you attend. So Tom attends loads. You attend three. Which three networking do you attend?
So the three networking groups I attend is obviously Synergy. So I attend the Ashford meeting there. I do the business clubs. And attend the Canterbury meetings there, and then I also attend BNI.
Mm, okay, and how long have you been a member of BNI?
So I joined the launch chapter of BNI in Faversham, which is where we're based, and that was, I joined there February.
So with the lovely Steve Nash?
Yes, indeed.
I once had Ivan Misner, who was the founder of BNI, on my radio show.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
Mm. All the way from his home in San Jose, California.
I'd love to have him on this radio show, actually. I think it'd be great to have BNI on here. Mm. But, I mean, Elle had a photograph taken with him as the youngest person to ever join BNI because she was 17 when she joined BNI.
Right.
I mean, it's actually been amazing for her, you know, from a personality and a, you know, growth aspect. It's been all of her best friends are from BNI. So it's not just about business, it's about so much more networking.
It's community, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
You're spending every single week with that group of people, you're going to build those relationships with
them.
But it also, BNI also comes with quite a bit of pressure and responsibility. Yeah. You know, you have this accountability and onus to try and provide work for everyone else.
Yeah.
And to do those referrals, to do the one-to-ones and to get on the training. And if you don't do it, you end up with a red mark against you. And
it's like back at school.
And
it's hard enough generating your own work, let alone generating somebody else's. Yeah, yeah.
So it does, you know, is a high-pressured sort of referral networking, whereas other networking, you know, like Synergy and the business clubs is about more harbouring relationships and getting to know people.
Mm, yeah, definitely. Mm. So I'm not going to ask any of you, how many different ones do you go to?
Me or the company?
The company.
We're probably at 2 or 3 events every single week.
It's amazing. Same as me. And I run an event company.
But it's not just me. It's
Colin. Yeah.
I'm assuming that's a huge chunk of your marketing and sales activity.
Yeah, so if I kind of look at where our leads come from, a good sort of 70-80% of our leads come through that networking, because we're building relationships. People get to know us. If you're going to trust someone with the keys to your company, which, let's be fair, IT have a lot of access to companies.
Exactly.
You've got to have that relationship. You've got to have that trust. And face-to-face networking gives you that.
Absolutely. It's a relationship-based business, really.
100%.
And as you say, it's not something you're going to fire an email to some complete stranger and go, do you want your IT service? And they go, oh, funny you should ask that. Yes.
But don't you think that most businesses now, really, that is the way they should be looking at, even big businesses?
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, a lot of big businesses are like, well, we turn over so many million, we don't need to go networking.
But you are starting to see some of the bigger businesses going there. So like Country Style Recycling, we see them at quite a lot of networking stuff. And they are a big business.
They are, that's right.
This is kind of anti-technology, really.
Go for it.
The more that technology is deployed in bigger businesses, the further away from their customers they tend to get. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they don't interact with them. Yeah, they have systems and AI and chatbots and all that kind of stuff. And some of them do really stupid things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, they kind of go a bit daydreamy.
Yeah, because there's no human interrupt that says, no, hold on a minute, that's stupid. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could give you a million examples. I won't take up any more of your time, but I did a whole radio show once on stupid things that technology does. But it's not a technology. It's the people that haven't planned it properly. That's the problem.
If you put like things like AI and processes and systems into the business correctly, then they're amazing. Yeah. If you just throw it at a problem, it's never going
to
work.
Yeah, and you have to have a something in there that enables you to back out of it and have a human look at it and go, that's daft. Yeah, we need to do something different there. Mm. But you know, it is a relationship-based business. 100%. And because bigger businesses are getting further from their customers directly, they need to go and talk to people, because it's the only way they'll find out how people are thinking about them. And I don't know about you. I discovered a year or so ago that if you have a problem with a corporate, the easiest way to get hold of them is on Twitter. Yeah. Because they have to respond, because it's in public. And I'm having a row with British Gas at the moment. Yeah. So I post, British Gas are crap. And they go, oh, DM us, DM us. But by which time, 3,000 people have gone, yeah, they are.
Public pressure.
Yeah. And it's public pressure, because they don't, if you just rang or went onto their bot, they just don't care. But the minute it's in public, they have to start to talk to you as a human. And therefore, I think it's better for them to do networking type things, because they get to speak to customers and potential customers, human to human.
So do you think, though, that some of them may think that social media is their window to see what their customers want now? Because
to some extent, although I've noticed a couple of big organisations have suddenly pulled out of X, citing political things, but basically what it is because they were getting a kicking and they didn't know what to do about it. The problem they have is, just because you're not on social media doesn't mean you're not on social media.
No, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But we'll still be talking about you.
They're still talking about you and you know, bad mouthing you, and you don't even know.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
And do you find, David, that, you know, with the trades, is there a time of day that they prefer to go networking, would you say?
Trades, we do like an early start as trades.
Like a bit of breakfast, they don't.
That's it. Yeah. Traditionally, I'm less on the tools now than I've ever been. But certainly in my younger days, we'd be meeting in a cafe, having our breakfast, getting our work, and then going out for the day. And you know, early morning stuff is, you know, we do. But the early bird gets the worm. So that's us as trades, and you know, typically home by 4. You know.
Well, I mean, my son's a trader, you know, because he's doing external cleaning, and you know, sometimes I say to him, right, you come in. He's like, no, Mum, I just want to go home. You know, I've had a real long day, especially if he's working in the rain all day.
Yeah,
it's like he's going home. He's soaking wet, and you know, and I say to him, well, you know, you need to come, and he's like, Mum. Stop nagging me.
There's no definitive answer. Tom will kind of back me up a little bit on this. I tried to start a networking group in Sheerness, called Sheppey Business Network. And we were meeting at 5 PM. There was only half a dozen, a dozen people met. And people were going, well, it's the wrong time. So we did a complete survey of everybody that had been and everybody that said they wanted to come.
Like an even split across.
And we
all
said, would you prefer the morning or lunchtime or the evening? One third wanted the morning, one third wanted lunchtime, and one third wanted the evening.
Well, it's funny, actually, because the big event we've got on the 25th, the first one we did in the afternoon, we had loads of women say, that's right when the school run is, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So I thought, right, okay, well, we go to the evening then. Then the traffic was unbelievable.
I think that was a bad day, though. There was accidents left, right and centre.
There were. There's about four accidents, weren't there? So we're now doing this one in the morning. So we're doing it at 10:30. So it'd be interesting to see. But all of our other events are obviously evening events. We do one daytime one because I went rogue one day.
Can I ask all of you your thoughts on this, talking technology? How do you feel about online networking?
Can't stand it.
Yeah.
I can't. I'm a generation that, or say generation, I'm a person that doesn't actually get involved in webinars, Zoom calls or anything. I had one this week and I just couldn't follow the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, I don't get it, and I much prefer to meet face to face.
I mean, I did it at the start of Synergy, and I know in B&I had to do it in that time, if everyone had to do it. It was awful because you could see that everyone was just waiting for their time to talk, and they actually weren't taking any notice of anyone else.
And you're mute the rest of the time.
I know.
And you're staring at your screen. Your emails are popping up in the corner. Your phone's ringing over there. You then hit breakout rooms where you're putting, you might not want to speak to those people. There might be someone else. And it's
and even,
so much nicer.
I mean, I've been to some where, you know, there's 200 people and you think, wow, you know, this is great. You're going to meet people, six people in a breakout room. I'm going to definitely meet 15 people. Three breakout rooms. And
same
I was
people.
And I'm like, who's organised this? You've got 200 people. Why am I in the same room with the same people? So, I find it all a bit, you know.
The reason I ask, I tend to agree with you. I don't like online meetings like that. But a lot of people tout that as the only way of overcoming this time barrier thing that, you know, they say, well, if you can do it online, then, you know, you could.
Don't build the same relationships.
I can see the benefit of, yes, you haven't got that hour travel back. Yeah. So, yes, you're just doing the event. But, yeah, you're not. It's so much easier face-to-face. I know when we have meetings with our clients, yes, we could absolutely do them by Zoom. And for some customers, that's what they prefer. So we go down that line. But face-to-face, you build that relationship. You get to know the people so much nicer. And it's you're on their premises, you're there, and it's, oh, while you're here, can you have a look at? Great, absolutely. That doesn't work over Teams or Zoom or
Yeah, no,
like
absolutely.
That.
Yeah. Mm.
The other thing is as well, I mean, our Business Academy is all online. So there are some benefits. So with the Business Academy, you might find that there's only like four people watching and engaging with it. But, I mean, with three of them, because of where I've been, I've had to go in and watch it afterwards. It's great watching it afterwards because then you go on and it's like, that was amazing. You can really take on board what they're saying because you can go back and listen to bits again.
Yeah.
And
I mean, when you're looking at sort of like online training, which is kind of what that vibe is going down. Yeah, you can watch it at your own. You can pause when you need to.
Yeah.
So watching back afterwards is probably a nicer way to do it.
It is. And the other thing with that as well is that lots of people have been asking us to do it in the room. Yeah. They've been saying, you know, Liam, we want it in the room, and even the trainers are saying they want it in the room. But for us to be able to do it every Thursday, and then we're going to have to charge, whereas at the moment it's free. So, I mean, it's such a fantastic resource. We had Chris Henry doing how to do scroll stopping photos last week. And, you know, the tips that I got from it, I mean, I was taking photographs yesterday. I'm like, right, I've got to do it in thirds. And, you know, I took on board everything he said. And it was just really good to be able to go and watch it back.
I suppose because it's recorded, you can go and look back again later if you kind of forget something or go, what did he say about?
Exactly, yeah. And it's in our feed, so people can just scroll through the LinkedIn feed or the Facebook feed, and it's always there. So, really good. Yeah, good question.
Online training. My eldest son lives in France, and he's a maniac. He's just a lunatic. He's rebuilding a house and doing everything, and he's doing it from YouTube videos.
He put
in his own central. Well, he's doing his own central heating at the moment. He's putting in a ground source heat pump.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. He actually bought a digger, a JCB's type digger and an excavator from China.
He does know you can hire those things.
Yeah, yeah. No, but he's a bit smarter than that, right? He bought a digger, a big JCB-like digger and an excavator from, he bought it on Temu, right? The pair together cost him 12 grand.
Right.
Including the container to ship them.
Yeah.
Right. They arrived. They work fine. It's very plasticky inside, but it's it does the job. He's dug the boreholes and he's dug the trenches and all the rest of it. And then he put them up for sale in France and sold them for 30,000 euros.
Clever.
But yes, he teaches himself how to do everything. He did all the electrics, all the plumbing and everything for the house from YouTube videos.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Right, Tom, we are going to play your song. So why are we playing Schools Out by Alice Cooper?
So we love working with schools. And this one will be due to a recent, we actually put an article out this morning over the joys of the summer holidays. While everyone's off enjoying themselves, having a bit of a break. One of the sort of big providers to schools, Intradev's the company, they provide a bit of software, which is Single Central Register, which is where a lot of schools host their DBS checks and all their staff information, got hacked. Nothing to do with the schools themselves. It's actually the third party. So while they were all off sunning themselves, they had a few security breaches.
So did they manage to sort it before they went back to school?
The problem is, you're looking at people's passports, driving license data, not photos, but the data that's on them, their national insurance number, their date of birth, everything has been compromised.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, you've got a lot of unhappy staff, unfortunately.
Oh, wow. That's frightening. So if somebody wants to get hold of you, how do they do that?
If they want to get hold of us, they can either give us a call on 01634 218362 or pop along to our website at it-ms.co.uk.
Okay, fantastic. And obviously we have an advert going out, so you'll be able to hear Tom's phone number on the advert. And
ring it.
No, it still works. We have multiple numbers. It's fine. It's just not the number we ring out on.
Okay, so thank you so much, Tom. No worries. Please stay and listen to the interview with David. Okay, thanks, everyone.
Linda Cloke on the Business Networking Show.
Tired of IT headaches? Slow computers? Security worries? Lost files? Sound familiar? We've got your back. As Kent's leading IT support partner, we keep your business running smoothly, securely and stress-free. Call 0179 5342362 now and get your IT sorted.
reliable property management service or lettings agent. PJJS is a well-established property management and residential lettings company in Maidstone, Kent, which deliver an effective and efficient quality service. Call us now on +44 78 55 746 966.
Hello, Kent businesses. Tired of networking events that don't deliver? Synergy Networking Events has got you covered, whether you're a networking newbie or a seasoned pro. Our events make networking a breeze. Meet other businesses without the pressure. Enjoy pre-planned seating table moves and even a buffet. All for just £20 for non-members and £10 for members. Build relationships that last and get a result on your investment.
Right. David, that's it. That's adverts over with. We're going to go and do some more shout-outs in a minute and some more events, but introduce your business to us, please.
Okay, certainly. So my name's Dave Clark. I represent the award-winning Clark's Gas Services. We are based over in Faversham in Kent, and we enable homeowners to ensure the safety of their home by carrying out effective preventative maintenance, basically annual servicing, gas safety checks and repairs, on their heating systems. And that's regardless of whether they're on natural gas, LPG, oil, or even have an air source heat pump. So we try and sort of be a one-stop shop for them all.
Okay, what is LPG?
LPG is liquid petroleum gas. It's So you've got mains gas, natural gas comes out out the ground. Got gas meters and that's what the majority of people are on. But people who are out in the sticks that don't have mains gas put around, and Kent's actually got quite a few sort of towns and hamlets that don't have mains gas. Mm. They then have an option of LPG, which is bottled gas, or oil to heat their homes and heat their hot water.
Sorry, Dave, having been there myself, I said off air I had oil heating, and you quite often, as you drive around the countryside, you see LPG tanks in people's gardens for their heating. It always, I've looked at this many, many, many times, but it still fascinates me. There are lots of reasons why you can't use gas because it isn't available and all the rest of it. But very few people seem to actually go the route of having an electric boiler.
Electric boilers are out there and they're good. And they, for all intents and purposes, an electric boiler is 100% efficient. And everyone might go, wow, 100% efficient. That's amazing. In terms of efficiency, no, that would be a class D. In terms of efficiency, because of the way that it uses energy.
Right.
So, yes, electric boilers have a place, but they tend to be very small properties. So maybe a flat, right. Very small house that's well insulated, purely because you would never be able to get an electric boiler big enough to heat, say, a four-bedroom house.
Right, okay.
It would just literally eat too much electricity that the cutout would basically burn itself out.
Right.
Well, which is one of the reasons why heat pumps is an excellent alternative to an electric boiler. Still right. using electricity, but it's the way that we can
convert it. It's the way you're using it. Yeah, absolutely.
So okay. How many people are going for heat pumps? Because heat pumps are quite a bit more expensive than boilers, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Mm. There's no other way of getting around it. Yes, a heat pump is a costly investment. Some businesses are doing really, really well with it, mm-hmm. and some businesses aren't. It's a string to our bow, and it's growing. It's not as big as we'd like it to be, but at the moment we can manage the installations that we've got coming up, and we can manage the work that's coming in for it. But we'd like more of heat pumps. SGS Energy, based over in Thanet, I think they cover most of the southeast. That's all they're doing. They're doing that day in, day out, and they're doing really well with that.
So new homes having it?
Some new homes are having it. A lot of new homes are having it now. And in fact, sort of any house that's built after 2010, 2011 should have a good swap, if they can, to a heat pump, because it'll be that'll be a very cheap. In terms of everything else, a cheap install for them.
So if you was to, I've been in my house for 10 years.
Yep.
I'm hoping the boiler carries on a bit longer, but yeah, because I want to have my eyes done. So basically, if mine went down, why would you get me to have a heat pump rather than replace my boiler, or would you?
So there are certain things that I would be looking for. I mean, obviously, you know, we're going back to face-to-face visits, I'd have to come around and have a look at it. This isn't something you can do over Zoom.
No.
So it would definitely be a face-to-face visit. So what I'm looking for is, how old is your house?
10 years.
So it's a 10 years house, so that would be 2016 that it was built. Do you have a combination boiler?
I have no clue what you're talking about.
Right. Fantastic.
It's a big white box. It lives in a cupboard.
Oh, yes,
done.
It is, yeah.
Have that's... you also got, a cupboard in the middle of your house that's got a big white tank in it?
No, in my kitchen at the edge of the house, yeah.
So you just got something in the kitchen on the edge. You haven't got any other rooms or anywhere like that?
No, no.
You haven't got an immersion heater or anything?
No.
So, yeah, so you've got a combination boiler.
Okay.
So, yes, we can fit a heat pump to your house, but we need to find space for an airing cupboard.
Oh.
So that's, you know, what one of the things that we'd need to consider is the fact that it's not just about putting an air source heat pump, which will go outside. It's about having a hot water tank to heat up. It's about having possibly volumizers.
That sounds like it's going backwards.
Well, yeah, but would you not traditionally put that where the old boiler was?
You could do.
Yeah, it depends.
You could do,
space,
but it depends on where that is. If you've got a combination boiler that's in, say, a kitchen cupboard that's over to the left, you've got a nice corner cupboard underneath it, you haven't got any space.
Right, okay.
But they do. There are units out there that will look like a big American fridge freezer that you can sort of stick in, and that would sit sort of as part and parcel of your sort of white appliances in your kitchen.
You can't keep your chops in there, though.
No.
When I moved into my house, one of the things I felt so posh because, you know, I've got cupboards in front of my washing machine and that, and I was like, oh, this is really classy. Oh, no. So when someone said to me, you know, why don't you get an American freezer? I was like, no, you know, because it won't go in the cupboard. Why would I do that?
Yeah, no, you've got to have a big fridge freezer. Yeah.
Got to have it. So you said about going backwards in terms of a hot water tank.
Mm.
Actually, combination boilers are great, but they're great for small buildings or small properties. If you go to a larger property that has, you know, multiple bathrooms and a lot of hot water drawer on it, then a combination boiler would be completely unsuitable for that premises.
That's
anyway.
Because it wouldn't be able to keep up.
Absolutely.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Sorry, Dave. In my house, I recently, 2 years ago, I had a new boiler, new gas boiler. I can't have a condensing boiler in my house. It's too big. It won't work. I just got a big sod-off boiler, and I've got an immersion heater.
With combination boilers, you've got two things to consider. One of them, they can only do one thing at a time. So if it's running a shower all the time, it's not running your heating.
I didn't know that.
So if you've got five people in your house that are having a shower and they're 15 minutes a shower each, that's a long shower.
Your house is getting colder and colder.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's one of your things to consider. The other one is the amount of water that a combination boiler can heat up. Now, the best way that I can describe most combination boilers doing is if you can imagine a loaf of bread and that's sliced. Now, on alternate slices, you've got the hot water that's generated by the heat that's burnt in the gas. And on the other slices, you've got your mains water. If you run that water super fast through that loaf of bread, it's not going to get hot. So you have to slow it down.
Oh.
So you have a very limited amount of water that can actually pass through a combination boiler at any one stage. So if you go for, say, a 24-kilowatt boiler, which is your smallest combination boiler, it's massively oversized for the radiators, but it will only give you, in technical terms, 9 litres a minute of hot water.
Wow. Well, mine seems to work, but what happens is that when the last guy came out, because I pay this monthly thing, just I don't even know what the name of the business is. But anyway, he...
She has a very in-depth relationship with him.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very close relationship.
Yeah. Exactly. It's very personal, yeah.
So, because I used to use the guy in BNI, and he said to me, you need someone who does a monthly thing. So that's what I went for. But anyway, he tied a plastic bag to a thing outside and he said to me, if it fills up, then let me know. So I rang them and said, it's filling up.
And he said, it's raining.
and then it burst because it kept on filling up. And it's still, it's now just leaking all over the place, but the plastic bag is still on there. So yeah, what's that?
So that is going to be, so that's your pressure relief valve that he's tied a bag over.
Okay.
So that's a safety device that is installed inside any sealed system. So mm-hmm. a combination boiler is combining a lot of things. So let's wind back a bit and we're gonna explain what a heating system does and everything that's in a heating system, the difference between a system and a combination boiler.
Mm-hmm.
So everything in a system, you have an appliance that generates heat, so a boiler that could be fired by any means. You then have an area that's going to generate hot water. So if you didn't have a combination boiler, you're going to have an airing cupboard with a hot water tank. If you haven't got a mains-fed unvented hot water tank, you're then going to have tanks in your roof. So you're then going to have a cold water cistern and a feed and expansion tank. Now, we then split your gas appliance in your kitchen into three main types. Bearing in mind, nowadays, every single boiler is condensing. We then split it into three different types. One being regular. It just produces hot water that we can distribute around the system to heat up your hot water or your radiators. You've then got a system boiler. So we take the small tank out of the roof and we take the pump out of the airing cupboard and we stick it into the boiler. And then we've got a combination boiler, which we then take the hot water tank and the cold water tank and put it all into one appliance, which is why it's a combination boiler. Now, some of the older generation may be familiar with the old geysers or the multi-point water heaters. That's basically the operation of a combination boiler in hot water mode. You open a tap up, it heats up, it gives you hot water. So then going back to your system with the where you've had to put the bag over the pipe, so you're experiencing a pressure loss. So you've got a pressure that's in the system that's maintained in a manual basis. So you turn something on, you turn something off, and the pressure, you have a dial on the front of your boiler, that pressure is going to go up and down.
Mm-hmm.
So as a sealed system, we have to put safety devices in. Whenever you heat up a volume of water, it's got to expand somewhere. And that's what your tanks in the roof space did. It allowed that water to expand. When we move over to a combination boiler, we put an expansion vessel on it. And the expansion vessel should be, on part of an annual service, pumped up because it has an airbag inside it. And that airbag allows the water to expand into it. When that's not pumped up, which gets done on a service, it can cause your pressure to rise up and down. So whenever you run your radiators, your pressure flies up to 3 bar. Your then pressure relief valve then starts letting by. That then drips outside. You end up with mess. The pressure goes down. You fill it up with fresh water. And it's a constant cycle that goes around. So you've likely got an issue of your pressure relief valve being broken. So that's now dripping. You've got pressure that's constantly coming into your system, which could be a defective filling loop. And you've probably got a flat expansion vessel.
So maybe that new boiler is going to be coming soon then.
Yeah.
With regards to water pressure in boilers, could it also be affected by the main supply?
So yes and no. So when you've got your dial that you have on the front of your boiler, that's going to be what you control and set at.
Yeah.
And so that
normally about 2.1 bar or something like that.
You want it between 1 and 1.5
right.
when the system's cold.
Right.
If it's hot, you're going to expect it to come up to around about 2, but it yeah. shouldn't go above 2. When the system's running and all the radiators are hot, it shouldn't go above 2.
Okay.
If it goes above 2, you haven't got expansion space, which could be...
It doesn't go above 2 because I watched a YouTube video to see what how to do it myself because I got fed up with ringing them. So I turn the blue tap off, then I turn the black tap off, and then it goes up to about 1.5, and then I turn them back again on.
So you're just adding more water into the system.
Yeah, you're
constantly so Linda, you need to get that fixed so you don't top it up.
Okay,
you shouldn't need to top it up.
Look at his face.
About the most you should top it up is maybe once a year.
You're now looking really concerned, Linda.
Yeah. So one of the things that you're going to be doing is you're introducing fresh oxygenated water into a heating system that has iron in it, which is your radiators.
Okay.
So your fresh oxygenated water is going to circulate around and it's going to start rotting the inside of your radiators, which is going to start increasing the amount of sludge and debris that's going to be generated, which is then going to go into your boiler, block up your plate heat exchanger, cause your three-port valve to seize up and break your pump.
Yeah. Okay, so you are...
Do you want a quote?
Linda's about to call you.
So you are looking for more domestic work, is that right?
We are domestic engineers.
Domestic engineers. So do you do one of the things where you do get rid of the sludge in radiators, and is that something you would need to have done every year?
So, yes, we do. So that's a process called a power flush. Where we can come along with a machine, we take the pump out, we stick our high velocity pump on it, we then circulate some cleaning chemicals around, we agitate the debris, we catch it in a magnetic filter, take it out and replace it with fresh water. And then the most important bit at the end of that, we then treat it with chemicals.
Okay.
So the chemicals that we use are inhibitors and they inhibit the process of corrosion.
Okay.
Now, on a yearly basis, any reputable heating engineer should be checking your water content in the radiators. It's a simple test. We use a day pro check, and that allows us to check for the majority of inhibitors that are on the market and lets us know what the corrosion levels are, what the pH levels are, and what, more importantly, the inhibitor levels are, so that we can then make sure that the system is protected against corrosion.
So if I did have it done, would that stop having to replace all my radiators as well?
Yes. Is
that right? Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
I think you've got a customer,
yeah,
Dave.
You have. to be fair, Linda, I think you need to start off with having a service done, a proper service on the boiler.
Not the guy who put the plastic bag on my thing,
no.
Then. I'm paying monthly, right, okay.
No, by the way, we do a monthly plan as well.
Yeah.
No plastic bags, no.
We don't do plastic bags, but we will for your monthly plan, we will look after the boiler. We've got various different plans to suit our clients, depending on what you want and what you need. But we'll cover the boiler, we'll cover the radiators, we'll cover the pipework, the radiator valves. It doesn't cover the cost for a power flush, but it will cover the cost for testing whether you need one.
Okay.
So we will do that on a yearly basis. Every time we come along to service the boiler, we will draw off a little bit of water and we test it. You know, we have a little visual check, which lets us know what's going on with it. And then we do the chemical dip test, which then allows us to understand what is going on with your system. And then we can advise you accordingly.
I mean, one of the other things that I found when I was going networking, obviously I was seeing people's, you know, presentations, particularly the people in your industry, they used to bring in things like the power flush and they used to bring in like the water that's come out of it. And it's amazing the difference, isn't it?
Yep.
Have you ever thought about doing something like that when you come to our networking to just try and visualise what? Have you ever thought about doing that?
Or? Yes. Walk around with dirty water.
I know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have a sample here. Oh, not that sample. No. I have that sample here.
So, yeah, there are lots of different little gimmicks that I have at the office that I can bring along. In fact, I'll bring one along just for you for the next time we meet up, and you can see the difference. It's a little bottle. It's made by Fernox because they're the filters that we use and fit onto systems. We like the Fernox Amiga ones because they're nice, solidly built brass units that have a magnet inside them. And they give us a test kit that shows us that if you pull the magnet out, shake it up, you end up with black water. You stick your magnet in and it catches it. Because essentially, it's the inside of the radiators, which are majority steel, it's rust, it's iron, it sticks to the magnet.
Mm.
So,
and do you find that I've got a really old house? Yeah, it's Victorian. And I think the central heating system was also an original Victorian.
Right, yes.
That corrosion inside of the pipework and mm-hmm. the radiators, does that eventually eat its way outside?
Can do.
Yeah.
It can do. It can cause pinholes in copper pipework. It can cause the radiator seals to leak, the pins on your TRVs to stick and things like that. It is a real silent killer of heating systems, really. I mean, we talk about the silent killer of carbon monoxide. Don't even get me started on that. But, you know, in terms of mechanically, it is content. The water content going around the radiators, going around the boiler, is the one that if you can keep on top of it, keep it clean, keep it treated, it's going to stop your system from breaking down and having issues.
So when I had my B&I guy talking about the carbon monoxide, he always checked that at the same time as he did the boiler thing, but the one that comes now obviously doesn't, but the one that I had from there he used to. Do you do that as well when you do it?
Yeah, so we check for carbon monoxide alarms. Carbon monoxide alarms should be fitted with every new boiler nowadays. That's actually a legal requirement. When we do a service, one of the checks is a flue analysis. So we actually check the emissions coming out of the boiler to make sure that there's, you know, the CO is going to produce carbon monoxide. If it's burning a carbon-based fuel, unless you're in a lab creating 100% combustion, you are going to produce carbon monoxide. That you're not going to be able to get away from. What we need to do is make sure that we're not producing a dangerous amount and that it's not discharging in a dangerous manner. So we're making sure that all the flue seals are intact, that the case seal is okay, the burner gasket is fine, that when it goes out the flue's clear from debris. Don't even get me started on people who want to put wisteria up the side of their house and don't touch it. All of that contributes to how an appliance burns and the combustion process that happens with that.
So tell me what would happen, like, because obviously, you know, a lot of women who are maybe living on their own, they just want their house to look pretty. I mean, they wouldn't even think about it wouldn't even enter their heads.
It's not just women, it's anybody, isn't it? People, if the house is warmish, they're fine. If they get in the shower and it's warmish, they're fine. Yeah, they don't really think about it until the boiler stops.
It's wrong.
Yeah. I didn't even know that having wisteria up the house could impact. So if you had it up the house where the boiler is, I didn't.
No. It's worse than that. You should never have wisteria on it because it eats into the brickwork.
Well, yeah, that's the reason I wouldn't have it on there. But so what does it?
So what we've got, the majority of boilers nowadays are what we class as fan-assisted room-sealed appliances. Mm. So you've got a pipe that comes out the wall. But it's actually two pipes. It's a pipe within a pipe. So the outer area draws the air in, and then the inner pipe pushes out the combustion products. If you've got plants growing around it, they're going to start filling up the air inlet. Mm. So we're going to start starving that boiler full of air, and therefore it's then going to increase the amount of carbon monoxide that's being produced because it's creating more and more incomplete combustion. Mm. So it should be all around your flue area, the pipe that's coming out the wall, it should be completely clear.
And the wisteria is feeding on the output of your boiler and becoming sentient.
It is one of a common thing when we go around to people's houses and we inspect inside. We then go outside and there's just all these plants and that lot. Yeah. We're just going, you've got to cut it down. You've got to make space and keep it clear.
Mm. Wow.
Dave, I want to ask you another question because I've kind of lost track of this because there's been not on anything you've said. This is the politicians and their net zero. There was talk initially that gas boilers would cease to be sold for new houses from 2030.
So that's actually something they've been trying to do from 2016.
Right.
So they've been trying to stop gas appliances from going into new builds.
Yeah.
Gas appliances are still going to be available across the market, especially for retrofit. Yeah. But in terms of new builds, there is a drive. How can I put this? We have been spoiled with the luxury of having cheap fossil fuels.
Yeah.
We now recognise the fact that fossil fuels are contributing to greenhouse gases and that the UK heating market, especially for domestic, is, I think it's about a 60% contribution to the net production in the UK. So we have to do something and we've got to start somewhere. So new builds are the easiest ones to start with.
Yeah, of course.
Because if we build the house right in the first place, we don't need to put so much heat in to heat it. And therefore, we can then make the best of how a heat pump's going to work, how it's going to operate. And that's, you know, we need to make a start on that. When you start looking into retrofit systems, trying to fit a heat pump to a retrofit system, that's when your costs go up, which is what you were mentioning earlier, Linda, because it's not just about having a look at the boiler. It's about having a look at the rest of the system, the pipework, the radiators, and what we need to do there to make a heat pump work efficiently.
Yep.
Because there's no point trying to fit a heat pump if we can't actually make it affordable to run. So, you know, that's
so is it the work involved to install the heat pump that's the biggest kind of cost?
Yeah.
Rather than actually the equipment itself.
Yeah, the equipment. So there's a couple of initiatives that the government are providing us at the moment. One of them being the boiler upgrade scheme, which is $7,500 that they give to you as a grant, so you don't have to pay that back. And the secondly, that the installation and any works involved doesn't have VAT on it. So there's a couple of things to go for it. If you did just a straight swap and didn't need to change anything inside, you potentially could only need to spend £500.
Wow!
So if you decided to upgrade to, you know, and you didn't mind having an airing cupboard in your house,
yeah.
Then if you decided to do that and you had it fitted, would your monthly costs go down?
That's the aim of the game, and in many cases, yes, it is. Provided that we can get the lowest. And I know I'm going to go into technical here, and I'm really apologise for that, but this is just the way that my mind works. We have to lower the flow temperature going into the radiators. So to lower the flow temperature and for you to get the same heat out of that radiator at a lower temperature, we have to increase its size. So we have to make it larger. So that's where the increased cost starts coming in, because we also then have to start maybe changing pipework to make pipes bigger.
So can you, with an airflow pump, what's it called?
An air source heat pump.
An air source. Can you have underfloor heating?
Underfloor heating is the best.
Yeah.
For it.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Why?
Why? Because of the low flow temperature that you have for underfloor heating.
Mm. What, sorry to interrupt, Dave. What kind of temperature are we talking about for flow control?
So a radiator. Generally, a radiator system. If it's not a brand new radiator system, we're going to be looking at around about 70 degrees temperatures. Mm. Celsius. For a heat pump, we want to get it below 55. For underfloor heating, we're looking at 35.
Right.
Mm. See, I prefer underfloor heating because I mean, it really
keeps your toes warm.
Well, but also it winds me up that I want to put a bed in a certain position. I can't because there's a radiator there.
Yeah.
So I don't, they're just getting my way.
I think that's a huge issue. Radiators in a way, and and you get stupid things like people put radiators under windows and stuff like that,
and then a curtain in front of it,
and a curtain in front of it, and you go,
I mean, nowadays there's no wrong position to put a radiator in. You know, traditionally it used to be we put them under the window because it stops the drafts, but then people got long curtains, they put them over the front of them, you heat up the window space, it all goes out the window, doesn't heat the room up. So then we put them into a different place. But underfloor heating is a much better way of heating the house. You have nice warm feet, your heat rises. So if you have 21 at air temperature, you know, where your head is, that's a nice comfortable temperature, but your feet could be at 22, 23.
Mm.
And then when your ceiling level is, where it's got useless heat, it's, you know, it's a lot cooler there. Mm. Whereas with radiators, we heat the top space first. So radiators, although a radiator sounds like it's going to radiate heat, about 80% of the heat given off by a radiator is through convection currents. So it's the airflow going over the radiator and the fins and the cycle that it goes around the room, rather than the radiated heat that comes off the front panel.
So, again, I can only talk about my house. So my house has got the screeded concrete floors.
Yep.
So would you have to dig them out or would you have to raise the floor? How would you put – because you've got to put something underneath it, haven't you, for floor heating?
So, it all depends what you're talking about. I mean, because you can get underfloor heating that's like a mat. I've got one in my bathroom. Yeah, so it's like a heated mat that's under the tiles.
Oh, so it's not like pipework and that?
No, but Dave's talking about pipework for heating.
So there's two main types of underfloor heating. You've got your electric underfloor heating. That's really cheap to install, really expensive to run.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your hydronic stuff, which is your wet pipes, and that's really expensive to install, especially in a retrofit situation, but it's really cheap to run. So it's those two things, and it's still. I'm going to start going off track here, so we'll come back to costing electric and why in a second. But if we go to your installation, we'd have to take up every sort of floor covering that you've got,
we'd have to then make sure that you've got an insulated screed. So it might be sort of an export, and you know, we've got to investigate, do a core drill down and see whether you've got insulation. If you've got insulation, we can hire a router, route out your screed, run your pipe work, and then put a thin screed over the top of it, fill the gaps in. Job done. If you haven't got an insulated screed, we could then lay a polystyrene routed board down and then run our pipes in that, and then we can put a layer on top of that. But then that starts building up your floor covering by a good inch.
I was going to say, how much is it? So
no
about
tall
an inch.
People in that house after that.
No. Yeah. No tall people. Yeah.
There's no tall people in my house anyway.
So it can be done, and there's lots of different underfloor heating systems out there, especially for the wet system, especially for first floor systems, retrofits. It all depends on the site survey and what gets done.
We're really getting loads of free information here from David. Keep going, mate. You know, we're all busy going, how much? Oh, I might go for that.
I know.
So I touched on it earlier on. It's something I actually want to talk about is you know, why a heat pump? Why is everyone sort of, especially the government, why are they sort of going down the line of why a heat pump such a good idea for the UK market? People are going, oh, they're never going to work. They do work. I have a 1960s house. I have a heat pump on it, and it's brought my bills down by about £500 a year. So, you know, it works well. I had to insulate the walls. I had to increase the insulation in the roof. You know, there are measures you need to do. You need to wrap first, heat later.
But if you'd wrapped it and you'd had normal heating, would you still be saving £500 a year?
Absolutely.
Right, okay.
So if you wrap it, you're going to reduce your fuel costs regardless. And that's something you should always be, if you're considering a heat pump, actually, first off, investigate your insulation. How much can you reduce your heat losses by? In terms of the projected future, where we know that the UK domestic market is consuming so much carbon and we need to reduce that carbon, we need a multifaceted attack on the domestic market to try and reduce that down. And how that looks is various different projects, whether it be heat pumps is one avenue, electrification in terms of electric boilers, which we discussed earlier, or a change away from natural gas to hydrogen and doing that. And I have my own theories and opinions on that, which I do believe we are eventually going to switch over to hydrogen. But I think you'll find that hydrogen will be more expensive. So where natural gas is the cheapest fuel at the moment, and during peak periods, you can see on the UK network for energy how, during the winter period, a third of it is produced by natural gas. When we change over, we've got an increased amount of renewables, and we're now using electricity to produce hydrogen. That hydrogen is going to leapfrog electric and cost more. So those people who can't afford to get over to a heat pump, they're going to be the ones that are going to suffer. So in terms of a heat pump and why heat pumps are so good, I'm going to start talking about COPS. Now, they're not cops and robbers or anything like that. COPS is a synergy and a pseudonym for coefficient of performance.
Yeah.
How much energy we need to put in to how much energy we get out. So your kettle that you have at home makes hot water, your immersion heater, your underfloor heating that you had in your bathroom, that's a COP of one. For every 1 kilowatt of energy you put in, you get 1 kilowatt of heat out of it. What a heat pump does is it takes that 1 kilowatt of energy, puts it into a compressor and runs a refrigeration circuit, and it will generate 3 times the amount of heat. So we then call that a COP of three. So for every 1 kilowatt of energy we put into a heat pump, we will get 3 times the amount of energy out of it. And that's what makes them so efficient, is that way of being able to convert that heat energy. We're not using electricity to heat something. We're using electricity to power a device to pull heat out of the air to then pump it into our house. And everyone around this table, believe it or not, actually has a heat pump in their home. They probably just don't realise it.
Your fridge.
Exactly that.
Clever.
So your fridge freezer at home, it's a box. We're taking low temperature heat from inside, and we're expelling it in high temperature heat out the back of the radiator on the back of the fridge. That is a heat pump.
Well, I never. How did you know that then?
I know everything.
Been to a few pub quizzes, I think.
Yeah.
I'm going to just go for a natural And have you got any more events?
Because, yes, I have. I have indeed. Sorry, I'm fascinated talking to Dave.
I know.
Really interesting stuff, that. Right, on the 18th of Thursday, which isn't tomorrow, as we've already decided, it's the Thursday after.
It's a week tomorrow.
It is a week tomorrow, yeah. Thank you. There is the long game at Canterbury, which Linda mentioned earlier. Pints and Prosecco at 6:30.
Yes, so that's the lovely Steph and Lisa, and that, have you been to that, haven't you?
I went to the first one, yeah.
Have you been to them yet? So they're really relaxed, and absolutely brilliant events, aren't they?
That's still at the ship.
It's still at the ship inn,
lovely,
yeah.
Venue.
Yeah, lovely.
Okay, so, and then there's Entrepreneur's Circle, 6 to 8 o'clock on the 18th. I don't know where any of these things are.
That's Edenwood Place.
Yeah.
Edenwood Place in Maidstone, up Bluebell Hill.
Yeah, again, lovely venue.
Yep. Okay, and then there's also Ripple Networking at 6:30.
Yes, so that's the new one. So that is Kieran Brown, and he used to run the events for another company, did such an amazing job of it. I think he thought, well, I'm going to start doing my own.
Yeah, I think he loved running those.
I'd love to support him, but as we've established, there's quite a lot of things going on, and we're already booked in with the girls. I bought my tickets. So we'll be going to that one. But do you still go networking, Paul?
Very rarely. I did go to a new venue 2 weeks ago, which was interesting, which was Wadhurst Castle.
Ah, they came to our Tunbridge Wells event, actually.
Yeah. So I went to Wadhurst Castle for a networking event. Mm. Now, they are promoting it as a networking event for other people to hold events there. Mm. But, of course, nobody knows about it yet, so they held their own there.
Makes sense.
And I went there 2 weeks ago, and it's a very interesting place.
Ah, okay. Was there parking?
There was lots of parking.
Easy to get to?
It's pretty easy to get to. It's in the village of Wadhurst, but it's pretty easy to get to. That's on the Kent-Sussex border, just, you know, Tunbridge-Wellesley way.
Yeah.
A fantastic venue, beautiful, beautiful place. The outlook and everything. There's 140 acres of grounds there, and just wonderful place to look out over. The castle itself is a little bit of a folly.
Okay,
it is actually a private home.
Yeah,
but they open up some of the rooms for you to use. It's actually a wedding venue for the most part.
Oh, that makes sense.
The castle is all turrets and stuff and crenellations, but it was actually a Victorian manor house, really, but they built it to look like a castle, and it does look like a castle.
So the young lady
that's all you need.
Yeah.
It's Katie, isn't it?
It's Katie, yeah.
Yeah, because she came along to our event,
So I went along to their inaugural networking event, which is the first networking event I've been to for a long time, because I just got networked out eventually. I'm trying to retire. I'm in my 70s. I promise myself I will retire when I'm 50, and I'm just such a liar.
So yeah, you might have missed that mark.
Yeah, I promised myself I was going to retire when I was 50. That's never going to happen. I reckon I'll be working until I'm about 90. Right, okay, so some more shout-outs. Sheila Winter, yes, please, Linda. She helps the nation to not waste time or money. Do you know anyone who is paying more than £5 per month for their mobile SIM? Do you know any homeowners who would like up to £150 welcome bonus for deciding to save money on their household bills? Get in touch with me for all of this, John and Sheila at minibills.co.uk, 07720 844 362. Emma Everson is also Utility Warehouse. She's there coming to our event this evening in Whitstable. So we're over there at the beautiful Crescent Turner Hotel. Have you been there yet, Paul?
Crescent Turner?
Yeah.
I went there years ago. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I nearly bought it once.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, that would have been an amazing buy.
It was owned by a Moroccan chap that owned a Moroccan restaurant in Whitstable. And he put the hotel up for sale, and I went over and had a look at it.
Wow. I mean, that is just such a fantastic
I made
venue.
Him an offer.
Did you?
Yeah, he wanted double figures, so I offered him 10 quid. He wanted more.
I can't believe you offered 10 quid for that venue. It's gorgeous. I would love a venue like that. Anyway, so Gary and Emma Everson, would you like to pay for Christmas without getting into debt? If you've got 3 to 5 hours a week spare, we can show you a flexible way to earn the extra money you need to give your loved ones a special Christmas they deserve. Pop us a message. That's Gary and Emma and it's at uwbiz.co.uk, 07908 228 210. Denise Holland said, attention athletes and coaches. So Denise was our first lady who did the training on the Business Academy. Absolutely amazing. I've also, she's got a new book which I've read, which is amazing as well. So, but I can't remember the name of it. She's going to kill me. So attention to athletes and coaches. Do you want to level up your game but find that your mind is holding you back? Ah, with her new book, Play Freely, The Spiritual Key.
Like to athletic-
I was just going to say that. Isn't it called Play Friendly?
Oh, dear. Coming out this October, Denise is here to help you tap into the zone state within flow, confidence and clarity. Sound like it resonates? Book a free discovery call today. Excellent book. I read it and really enjoyed it. And it really does help you. I mean, let's face it, we need to get our mind in order. And, you know, many things that we think about, you don't need to think about really, because it's never going to happen, is it? So you can contact Denise, info@deniseholland.org, or call her on 07770 923 210. So, and then Steph has asked us to give a shout out for Pints and Prosecco, but we've already done that. So, yeah, we're looking forward to seeing her on the 18th. But as I say, there's quite a few other events going on that night, but we'll be there along with all the other people that they've got going. So, should be a good event.
I'll be at EC, so I won't be there.
No, you won't be there. Dear, oh dear. So, tell me a little bit about how you got into what you do. If you've always done what you do.
So I've always done this since I left school. Okay. Not worked for myself, just worked in the plumbing and heating industry. I kind of fell into it, really. I left school. Someone told me, you're going to make a lot of money if you went on the tools. So I ditched the job offer that I did have, went and joined the tools and realised, blimey, it's a lot of hard work, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then I worked myself through different companies, building up experience in different fields of the heating industry. Always been on the domestic side. That's all I've ever done is domestic side. Mm-hmm. And then I suppose like most people who start up a small business, they have this, you know, wake up in the morning, they go, why on earth am I going to work to solve all the issues and problems that my current employer has got when I could be doing stuff my way and probably being able to do a much better job. And mm-hmm. That's when I thought, you know what, I'm going to go and do that. So I started my own business, and that was back in 2011.
Right.
And how many people have you got working in your team now?
So in the team, in the office, we have a fantastic young man called Jack. He is our IT guru, but also does a day-to-day admin as well. And he's a brilliant young man. Also, backing him up is Claire, who's our sort of general manager, and she just makes sure everyone pays on time and follows up on things. And then there's a lot of crossover in the office and the systems, because you know, the two people are a lot to. We have a lot of phone calls that come in and need to be administered, so they, you know, they work together and work on that. Out on the tools, then we've got James, who's our lead engineer. He's been with us for 5 years now. We've then got Dave, and that's our sort of service team. And then we've got an installation team, which consists of Ben. He's been with us for about 2.5 years now. Ben has, and then we've got a young man called Pete. He's our apprentice. And he's now doing his last year, so he'll be gas qualified at the end of that. And then we'll probably be looking to take on another apprentice. Cool. Once he's been cool. Qualified.
Can I ask you, Dave, when you made that decision in 2011 to start your own business,
mm-hmm.
Talk us through the first few months of stopping working for somebody else and starting your own business. You know, what was it like? How did you feel? What are the issues that immediately came up for you?
So, I moved down to Faversham from South East London with my wife.
Right.
And we did that for childcare reasons.
Right.
So we come down back end of 2010, and I was driving all the way up to Bromley to do the daytime job and then coming back again. So that was sort of one of the draws in it. So I decided about February time 2011 to go, right, this is what I'm going to do. So I started working in the evenings and weekends, trying to build up a bit of a customer
base. Right, okay, yeah.
And then my qualifications. So what you may not realise, but as a licensed operative for working on gas, we have qualifications that need to be renewed every 5 years.
Yeah.
To allow us to work on the various different appliances.
This is gas safe.
Gas safe operator.
Yeah.
And then other companies administer the qualifications.
Right.
So, and if you ever look on the back of a gas safe, you'll see all the areas that someone can work in.
Right.
So my qualifications were coming up to being renewed, and the company that I was working for were like, well, we need to put you in for your renewal. And then I was a bit sceptical as to whether, if I left, how much I'd have to pay them back. So I thought, well, I'm on this path to opening my own business, so I might as well go and pay for the qualifications myself.
Right.
So whilst I did that, I did some research in the area and found out where there weren't so many qualified engineers. Because when I originally did the survey, looked into it and seen how many gas safe registered individuals there were in Faversham, there was something like 40 or 50. And then going wider afield, there's quite a few more. So I was like, okay, so what don't they do? What can I specialise in so that I've got something to go out with? And that's when I realised that LPG, we had a lot of LPG clients, just not so many people to cover it. So I upskilled on LPG, and then I thought, as I'm in the training centre, I might as well do oil and get qualified in... I can't even say that word now.
New words coming out.
Yeah, that's it.
He learned oil.
I learned... That's it. I learned oil and went out and did that. And then, haven't really looked back since. It's been hard work.
But what you just described is a real entrepreneur. It's a real business person. Someone that has thought through the strategy. I was talking about this on my show the other day. With people that start businesses without thinking it through and without doing any research, I've seen some horrendous things. I had a guy that mortgaged his house to raise £400,000 to develop a product to sell for 20 quid that you could already buy on Amazon for six, yeah? Because he didn't do any research. But not only did you do research, you actually thought strategically about what you needed to do.
Yep.
And that's really impressive, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, one of the things I was going to say, though, I mean, I do believe in business coaching, and I'm on a program now,
right?
Because one of the things that, you know, we go through life learning about how to do, you know, we go to school, we go to college, you know, you take on a new role at a job, you get trained up in that.
Yeah.
When I started the business, no one taught me anything about business. Yeah. I didn't have a clue.
Yeah.
You know, I knew how to fix heating systems. I knew how to install boilers to a really high standard.
Yeah.
But I didn't know how to run a business.
Yeah.
And although I strategized, I also didn't pay attention to what I should have done.
Right.
So it did cause problems.
How did you get your clients? Because that's the main thing that people struggle with. They start a business. Yeah. They just think, I can do this. I'm brilliant at it.
What I heard Dave say, that while he was still working, he was working for himself in the evenings.
Yeah.
Which is a really clever way to start something. Because you're transitioning, you know, without cutting everything off and going, right, I don't work there anymore. I've got no income. Yeah. Oh, and I've got no customers.
Yeah, kind of got one foot in both worlds before you make that leap.
It was a case of, right, I applied for my license, my gas safe license to operate. I got that. I took a sickie to get my inspection done. So, you know. It was horrendous. You know, working weekends, working evenings, just to try and build up a little bit of a customer base,
especially with a new family and a new house and a young family.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. I mean, my youngest daughter hadn't been born. But my oldest daughter was two and a half years old. It was, it was difficult, you know.
Mm.
I don't think anything that's worthwhile is easy. I think, you know, everything is, if you're going to take something out of it, you've got to put something into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Some people might know that I founded Jobs in Kent, a recruitment portal, and I did that in 1999, where when you rang a customer, they went, into what? Yeah. It took me 4 years to make my first £25.
Mm.
Didn't realise that.
Yeah. You know, and that's just the way it was. So I had to give it away free because people just didn't know what it was, didn't believe it would work.
You had to prove the value before you could charge.
Yeah, we had to, you know, and it's like a lot of things on the internet, especially. We got no clients and no jobs. So, you know, you have to do things to make it work.
Yeah.
And as you proved, Dave, you worked in the evenings at weekends. Mm. So did I, but doing something completely different, yeah, just to earn money while trying to get the company up and running, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So what of all, because obviously you've got accounts and, you know, sales and marketing now. I mean, I remember Elle, when we first started doing, we do social media, and she was like, Mum, we need a funnel, we need to do marketing. I'm like, what?
What's a funnel?
Yeah.
You use that to fill a bottle up.
I know.
Put salt in a dishwasher with one of those.
Yeah. So, and I just thought, well, it's sales, you know, just get on the phone. And no, it's not. Marketing is completely different.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to understand it. I mean, obviously now I do it all the time, but it takes a lot. So what was the hardest thing for you? Was it the accounts? Was it the...
Yeah, I'd say accounts.
Right.
Money, accounts, knowing my numbers, that is the hardest thing for me. And I think one of the things that possibly separates me from a lot of other business owners is that as much as I should be paying attention to the money and the profit and things like that, that doesn't really interest me. And it pains me to say that it just doesn't really interest me. What interests me is actually providing that service and doing a fantastic job for the clients, because I know that we can do so much better with the industry, considering that the industry is full of so many different cowboys.
I don't think you're alone in that, Dave. You know, most people, I think, Tom, probably the same, most people go into business to do what they do.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, you want to make a living, but you go in it to do what you do. He goes into it because he likes fiddling with computers. You go in it because you like fiddling with gas boilers or whatever, or heat pumps. Yeah. So that's why you're in business. But as you quite rightly say, when you're in business, you've then got all the rigmarole that goes with it. You've got to have accounts. You've got to file confirmation statements. You've got to tell people who are people of significant control. You've got to do VAT returns. You've got to do all that stuff. And most of us go, really? I don't, you know, I
just want to get on with my business
to do that. Yeah.
Unless you went out to become an accountant, you don't want to do accountancy.
No, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you run the wrong type of business, I've got some coffee shops, and that is hilarious for VAT. It is hilarious. Yeah. Do you want biscuits with that? Yes, please. What do you want? I'll have a hobnob. Okay, there's no VAT on hobnobs. You're fine. I want a chocolate biscuit. Sorry, I've got to charge VAT on that. Or can I have a bourbon? There's no VAT on bourbons, but they're chocolate. Yeah, but the chocolate's inside, not outside.
Really?
Really, really.
Oh, yeah. No.
Fantastic.
Yeah. There's a better one. Yeah. Would you like a cup of tea? Yes, please. If you're going to drink it here, there's VAT on it. Oh, I'll take it away. There's still VAT on it, right? If you let it go cold and take it away, there's no VAT on it. Oh, okay. What if I let it go cold and drink it here? No, there's VAT on it.
What on earth?
That is so
bizarre.
Who
comes up with these rules?
Yeah.
I wish I knew.
There, probably someone who doesn't have to enforce them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, because it gets, I mean, it even gets really confusing in the heating industry. So we've got 20% basically on everything. We've got 0% if we're fitting a heat pump. We've got 5% if we fit a room thermostat on its own, but it's 20% if we install it or if we're doing the boiler. So it's
just bonkers,
you
isn't
just,
it?
Yeah, you just can't get your head around it.
You would think that the easiest way to do this is go, do you know what? We're just going to charge 10% on everything.
I remember reading, I was really into self-development when I first got divorced a long time ago, but I read a thing called Conversations with God, and basically they said that the easiest thing to do with tax is just the whole world just charges 10%.
Yeah. Mm.
And then it would stop all the bureaucracy. It would save so much money of what's going on in the background, people trying to work out with their biscuits or chocolate or whatever, that it would just be so simple.
Yeah.
The other thing it said was about hemp, because obviously people use hemp for not good things, but it said if you use that for paper, instead of cutting down trees, there's so much hemp in the world that it would save an absolute fortune. Some of the things they said in there, and you think, why aren't they just doing this stuff? Because it's just common sense.
Yeah,
I mean, the title of the book people might not have liked, but, you know, at the end of the day, it was just common sense.
It's politicians for you, isn't it? They don't think things through from first. Well, when I worked in corporate, I instituted a thing called zero-based budgeting because I got sick and tired of every year my boss is coming to me and going, right, you had £40 million budget last year, you need to save 20%. And I go, okay, what don't you want me to do? Oh, no, we want you to do everything. We just want you to cut 20%. Yeah. So what most people do with their budget is they go, they're going to cut that. So I'm going to increase it 40% and then cut it 20%. Yeah. And that they go on year after year doing that. When I took over, I was head of a bank. I said, I'm not doing that anymore. We're going to have zero-based budgeting. Every year you start from scratch. Yeah.
That's a good idea.
And you tell me what you're going to buy, how much it's going to cost, and then we'll decide on what the budget is. And politicians ought to do the same with tax systems. We're just about to have another budget in November. Mm-hmm. They're going to impose VAT at a lower threshold. That's the planning at the moment. At the moment, you have to turn over 90K. Mm-hmm. They're talking about halving that to 45K. It's going to create mayhem because most small businesses will just close because they just go, I'm not working that out. I do not want to do it and I'm not going to work it out. So you'll lose hundreds of thousands of small businesses. Everybody's prices will go up 20% or however much VAT you have to charge on whatever your product or service is. Yeah. But they just don't think things through from first principles that says we'd be far better off if you just charged 10% on everything.
And I think one of the things that's quite important to distinct there as well, with VAT, the only person it ever hurts is the homeowner.
Yeah, it's the end customer. Yeah,
it's not anything to do. Or you know, most businesses, they can claim the VAT back or anything else.
Yeah.
So really the only people that's going to impact is the homeowners.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's a classic, politicians not understanding VAT when they impose VAT on school fees. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They thought they were punishing the schools. They were actually punishing the parents. And the IFS, who are the people that work this out, I actually had an argument with one of the architects of this. I said, you have forgotten capital reclaims. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, none of these schools are actually registered for VAT. So at the moment, they don't claim it back. Yeah, no, we've factored that in. I said, but they can claim back 10 years of capital expenditure. And he went really quiet. Eton claimed back £7 million. Yeah. In capital expenditure VAT going back 10 years. And they weren't the only ones. Mm. So, you know, politicians don't understand their own tax rules, and that's a lot of the problem. It's a nightmare. And it's not what we went in business to do. That's the main point, isn't it?
Most people go into business because they have a passion for what they do.
100%.
They don't have a passion for business.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they'd be running business schools, really.
Well, exactly. You can have a passion for VAT, but you then tend to be a VAT specialist.
I've got a passion for business. But anyway, but besides, let us know how people can get hold of you, please, David.
So you can get hold of us by direct dialing the office, which is 01795 530060. You can also WhatsApp that number as well. That goes straight through to our WhatsApp. Our email is heroes@clarksgasservices.com. We're on Facebook. Clarks Gas Services on Facebook. We're on Instagram. And we do have a website as well, which is clarksgasservices.com.
Are you telling me you don't dance on TikTok?
No, we don't dance on TikTok.
It's an opportunity.
By that facial expression, I don't think you're planning to either.
No.
And one last thing, Dave. We first met last year, when I was presenting an award to you at the Kent Business Awards.
Indeed, yes, we won Canterbury's Contractor of the Year 2024.
Cool. We've got this year's coming up soon.
Yep.
Are you in it?
Absolutely.
Have you been notified yet if you're a finalist?
Not yet. I think the Canterbury ones...
Yeah, they're still open. So, yeah, Canterbury and Ashford are still both open at the moment for. Okay, well, I look forward to seeing you at the awards ceremony.
And, I look forward to getting my gong.
Owning that golden envelope again and going, not you again.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Cool. Well, I just want to go through a couple of things we've got coming up in Synergy. So we're at Whitstable tonight. We launch our South East London franchise in Sidcup actually on the 1st of October. So we will be doing a founder membership there. I've got a tickle in my throat and it's really making my eyes water. I'm not crying, guys.
Really emotional about
it. I know. Getting really emotional about the cup. And next Monday, we're at Maidstone. And Maidstone's been growing really well. You ought to come and try our events, you know, because they're very different, Paul. These boys will tell you. Mm-hmm. And we get about 43 to Maidstone. But then we've got our big one on the 25th. And we've got sponsors. So Dave from Absolute is one of our sponsors. We've got Ben Leach from BLIT. And we've also, the Arida Hotel are sponsoring it as well.
Right.
And we've got another sponsor as well, which is Wix Boys. The Wix Boys.
Yes, I saw that.
Carl Cow. Right. So four sponsors for the event. It should be really good. Well, it's going to be really good. They always are. We've got over 70 people booked in and we'll have 120 people. So it's going to be an amazing event.
And when's this?
That's on the 25th of September.
Is that the summit?
10:30 a.m. Yeah.
That's not tomorrow.
No.
It's not the Thursday after.
No.
It's the Thursday after that.
It is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. A few weeks ago.
I got that. Wow. Yeah.
So, I mean, I really, really enjoy doing those. And did you come to the first one or have you not been to one yet, David?
I don't think I've been to one of those. I can pop my cherry later if you want.
So Tom's been. So Tom, how would you compare the big one? Because the Arida actually asked me to do that. They said, look, we want to attract more businesses into the venue. Would you do a big summit for us? I said, yeah, fine. I think we'd only been in business like 2 months when they asked me to do it, which was really, I felt really privileged they asked me to do that.
Well, you've got a reputation, Linda.
Have I?
You have, yeah. But aside from that...
yeah, I know.
You didn't specify good or bad.
No, I know, yeah. Everyone's laughing now.
Yeah, yeah. No,
all 14,000 listeners.
You've got a well-established reputation for running good events, and that's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I started life actually doing organising Pitch and Putt for the KCC.
Right, okay.
Organising those events, and then I started doing charity fashion shows.
Yeah.
Which was amazing. I worked with gyms around Kent and I'd used to say to the gym, right, you do the choreography and I'll give you the exposure. And that's it's about giving the people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then as a school governor, I did loads for schools as well, fashion shows and things like that, which were really good.
Mm.
But anyway,
fantastic.
These aren't fashion shows, are they?
Well, I don't know. If you want me to come along, I mean, I'll pick an outfit.
Strut your stuff.
Yeah, strut my stuff.
Just across the front.
Yeah.
So back to the question.
Yes.
How do you think the big events are different from the smaller events that we run?
Obviously, I was speaking at your last big event. And I suppose the smaller ones are more sort of focused on the tables. So, yes, you got your informal bit at the beginning and then it's very table focused. The bigger event, I quite liked the presentations that were going on. It gave you a bit more of a sort of in-depth look at a couple of businesses. I think when I was speaking, we had a social media marketer, an accountant, and then us. And that was quite nice to kind of get a bit more of a flavor of how they work, the way they work, what they do. You still had the table stuff and the questions and everything going on, but yeah, it was nice to get a bit more of a look into those businesses.
So we are giving people the opportunity to sponsor clubs now. So everyone who sponsors a club then gets 5 minute presentation. But I know the rookie club, there's a lot of theirs is focused on presentations, isn't it? And the one from Beth,
yes,
apparently last week was absolutely, I mean, I was on holiday, but they said Beth was absolutely excellent.
That's the second one she's done there as well.
Yeah, that's what Chris was saying.
Yeah. The rookie ones are definitely centered around sort of two presentations. So one is normally a business focused one and one's more of a mindset focused one, which is really nice because you sit there and whether it's about sort of productivity or just the way you're thinking, it's nice to kind of just take that little step back and listen for a few minutes.
And what other ones do you attend where they do get someone to do a I know BNI obviously does a presentation. What other ones?
So obviously the Invicta Chamber of Commerce ones.
Oh yeah.
They do.
They're quite brief though, aren't they?
The presentations, yes. Yes, it's very loud room presentation followed by very loud room. that sounds really bad, but I like their events because of the amount of people that go there, the types of people that go there. But unfortunately, because of the amount of people, they're very loud rooms.
To be honest, I went to one yesterday and it was fantastic. And the reason it was so good, I had more meaningful conversations at that one meeting than I have at any of their other meetings.
Yeah.
And the reason is because I could hear them. So I could actually hear what the people were saying to me. But there was only about 30 people, but it was brilliant.
That's quite small for those.
I know, it was brilliant.
I know, whenever we go to the chamber ones, it's always a case of pick a couple of people, have a chat with them, and then go to a side room. Just go outside slightly and have that sort of more in-depth chat. It's when the people kind of run around and try and speak to everyone. That doesn't work. You're just throwing business cards at people. There's no relationship there. There's nothing there. So yeah, the rookie ones are really good for their presentations.
They are.
So yeah, Business Clubs doesn't do presentations. Hive. I also do Hive Club, which is Edenwood Place's own networking group.
Yeah, I'd like to go along to that, actually.
You came to one, didn't you?
I came to one, yeah. But everything went blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I think that's the only morning one I now do. But it's a civilised morning one because it doesn't start till 9 o'clock.
I love all the people there as well, the Hive.
Yeah,
they're lovely,
really,
lovely people.
Really good
people.
Group. And yeah, that's every other week, the way they run, there's a presentation going on from a member and then also a business update from the previous speaker. So you get that bit of time. And again, they do, they've just recently started implementing that ability to kind of throw problems you're having at the group and sit and discuss about it, which is really good.
I know that I went to Nigel Whittaker's one. He was on my show last week, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And that was excellent. So you put a question to the room and then everyone sort of, you know, asks you questions to try and find out more in depth what your question is.
Mm.
It's a bit like a business coach, I suppose, but you've
What do you call it? Mind thingy, isn't it?
Mastermind type
thing. Masterminding, that's the one. Thank you, Tom.
So, yeah, absolutely brilliant and well worthwhile. So, look, thank you so much, guys. Thank you for coming along. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, loved it. It's been great.
So, Tom Revley and David Clark, and thank you so much, Paul, for stepping in last minute.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
It's been a great show, and I hope all of you have enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoyed your shout-outs and that you're going to be coming to all of the events. You're going to be very busy.
Yeah.
So let's remember that, obviously, I love networking, but remember, you have got to work as well.
Mm.
True.
Although it is working.
Yeah.
That's me. I'm going. Bye-bye.
Bye.